And welcome to the Midday. I'm Norman Gilliland with composer Michael Daugherty. Welcome to Wisconsin.
Great to be here.
Do you get over this way occasionally?
I'm doing research on a Frank Lloyd Wright project, so I've been in this area. Last summer I drove through to his...
Taliesin?
Yes, and stayed there a couple of days, looked around the ground, so yeah.
You want to describe this project a little bit?
Oh, I know it's going to be a piece for a concerto for strings, basically, for a group called the New Century Orchestra in San Francisco. Nadia Sonnenberg is the director and will be the soloist. So that'll be a couple years away.
This is something they've commissioned.
Yes.
Is your time mostly, I know, of course, you're at Michigan, but is your time mostly absorbed by commissions?
Well, I teach as well, but my time away from teaching is absorbed by my creative fantasies, you know, which is going all over the place. In fact, yesterday we went over to, what was the name of the antique store we stopped at yesterday?
J. Taylor
Antique Store down on the square down there, the Capitol. And he happened to be open. I guess he's not open all the time, but he happened to be open. It was late, 7 o'clock. We went in there and I spent about 2 hours looking over his collection. And actually picked up a fan dance advertisement from like the 30s. A glass thing was really cool, which he gave me a great deal on. But he has a Frank Lloyd Wright. He has a whole bunch of stuff down there. So anyways, I love to go to antique stores or bookstores wherever I travel or in Ann Arbor where I live, and I get ideas. So my mind is always thinking about things and coming up with creative thoughts, which then lead themselves into music.
But how often do you have the option of actually writing something that... I don't want to make the distinction between a commission and inspiration, but you see where I'm coming from. Something that just comes to mind without the external connection there.
Well, usually, you know, the commission really only defines itself as far as what the ensemble will be. You know, is it going to be an orchestra? Is it going to be a wind ensemble? Is it going to be a string orchestra, string quartet, whatever? So it's more the timbre, you know, the sound I'll be dealing with, and maybe the duration. We want a 15-minute piece or we want a 20-minute piece, whatever. But up to after that point, it's really my thing to come up with the idea I want. So I have all sorts of ideas that I think stockpile, and then then when the right instrumentation comes along, that I think will fit that. For example, with Frank Lloyd Wright, the fact he was a great lover of string quartets and had, you know, built that string quartet furniture that's in his homes, because he had string quartets come all the time and perform. So I thought that would be a great piece for strings. So that was a tie-in with the instrument. Or a flute concerto I wrote a couple years ago called Trail of Tears, about the Native American Indians. And, you know, the flute is an instrument that's a hybrid between, you know, Western music and Indian music, Native American Indian music. So I thought that'd be a good piece to write for that. So
you became a pianist. Let me see. I don't want to overstate it, but by dint of watching closely a player piano, there can't be too many composers, performers who came into music that way.
Well, the only other composer I know was Colin Nankera, who
he would be a
natural. Wrote the music for player pianos, the avant-garde composer. I should mention one other piece that you'll be hearing actually Friday night at the concert here at the University of Wisconsin, a piece called Motown Metal, which was, when I was asked to write a piece for this group in Detroit, I thought, well, you know, metal sounds and instruments made of metal, so it's brass and percussion instruments. So that's another case where I knew I wanted to do a piece about Motown. And then when that commission came along, I said, that's the perfect ensemble, the perfect sound for that kind of piece.
And as long as you've mentioned the concert, I should, too, give some details here. This is a collaboration between the UW and then Sun Prairie, the high school wind ensemble there. And you're going to be involved in a performance Friday night, that's tomorrow night, November 30th, 8 o'clock at Mills Hall. That's the Humanities Building at the UW concert, with pre-concert discussion at 7:15. But a couple of the Michael Daugherty works will be on the program, including the aforementioned Motown Metal. Then there will also be Bells for Stokowski, and there's another, On the Air.
Right. I just went to this high school this morning, and they were phenomenal. I couldn't believe, you know, the level of playing. And what's really exciting about being a composer today is that we have great orchestras, we have great wind ensembles, And it's interesting that it's actually the wind ensembles, although I do a lot of works with orchestras, it's really the wind ensemble world where the most music by living composers is performed. And it's interesting.
Yeah. Well, is that not where, how should we put that, most of the economic opportunity is for writing for winds, bands, that kind of thing?
Well, so yeah, it's economic, but it's also where the interest is. I mean, it's just because wind rep has been around for just, you know, like a century,
sure,
there's a need for more works. In fact, perhaps we have Scott here from our fantastic conductor from the university.
Sure.
And perhaps you could fill
Scott
us in.
Scott Swim.
Well, Michael and I were talking earlier about the collaboration that goes on around the globe between wind conductors and living composers, and the wind groups. The wind ensemble was really born out of necessity at Eastman with Fred Fennell in the early 50s, 1952, I think it was. So going from that to where we are today, these groups are so malleable. If you need a string bass player, there's string bass. If you need harp or piano or four percussion on keyboard instruments or whatever the composer calls for, those needs can be met through this malleable type of ensemble. But there's such a desire and interest in new music and pieces and collaborations between the players and the composers and their, again, the audience, that it's a very fertile ground that the wind ensemble people have just taken up, yeah, and are hoping to.
And you could also argue the other way. It's really not, when you mentioned the word economic, it's really the reverse. Actually, that's the reason that that some orchestras right now are having Santa Claus as their guest composer, the orchestras, whereas wind ensembles, there isn't the economic pressure. In other words, they can play music by living composers because there's not the economic pressure of ticket sales, you know, and stuff like that. So, which means that for us, for the composers, it's great because the wind conductors love us, and we love coming to their performances.
And it brings out some great music, too.
And it brings out some great music, yeah. And also, you know, you can write whatever you want. You can write as complex music as you want to. You can try whatever you want to try out. You know, if you've always wanted to write a piece for where the instruments are set up on the stage in a weird kind of way, or electronics, or you want to bring in dancers, you want to do video, whatever you want to do, where with orchestra, it's much harder because of the economic constraints, actually.
Sure.
If I could also add to that there are composers such as Michael, David Del Tredici, Aaron J. Kernis, and Jennifer Higdon. These are epic names in the music profession at this point in our history, and they're writing for various ensembles. So students who are undergraduates through graduate students at a university campus such as ours who can tackle the pieces of these composers, they're getting a significant musical experience regardless of what medium they're playing in. So if they are training in their mind, or their ambition is to play professionally in a large symphony orchestra, they're going to meet the repertoire of these same composers, just in a different medium, but still a significant musical experience for everyone.
So true. Yes, I know, yeah. The Madison Symphony is going to be playing another work by Jennifer Higdon, mm-hmm, in an upcoming concert. You are also, Michael Dougherty, one of the most, I suppose, how can I put this, eclectically inspired composers, all kinds of musical styles, I think even more so than most contemporary composers. And one of your pieces that brings some of those forces to bear is Strut. Is that the piece that you dedicated to, or is that the one that you had Paul Robeson in mind for?
Yes, it was.
Mm-hmm. The great actor-singer from back in the 30s and 40s, and what are the influences on Strut?
Well, it's a very vibrant piece. It's very alive. It kind of, you know, it evokes for me the Harlem Renaissance, and there's a connection with me. And then I'm from Cedar Rapids, Iowa, and the writer photographer Carl Van Vechten was from Cedar Rapids, and after he, at the age of 18 or so, he left Cedar Rapids, moved to New York, and he's the guy that photographed Robeson and many of the famous black actors and musicians in the Harlem Renaissance in the 30s. So there's a connection between where I grew up and Carl Van Vechten, and then this particular piece, Strut, and the Harlem Renaissance. Yeah.
This is Strut as performed by the Miramar Sinfonietta. Their conductor is Henry Pensis. set by my guest today, Michael Dougherty, and the performance came from the Miramar Sinfonietta. Their conductor was Henry B. Pensis, who was for a long time, associated with the UW-Oshkosh. And back with composer Michael Dougherty, and also Scott Teeple is here. He's the conductor of the concert that is coming up tomorrow night, actually. He is involved in this collaboration between the UW and the Sun Prairie High School Wind Ensemble that features three works by Michael Dougherty. And the performance will be tomorrow night, Mills Hall at the UW-Madison campus, and 8 o'clock is showtime. Well, having heard Strutt, okay, so that's inspired by Paul Robeson. I think you had a totally clear field when it came to writing an atombo, we should say, as a musical monument in the tradition of going back to the 18th century, at least. You had a clear field in writing atombo to another Wisconsin figure, Liberace, from West Allis. So what inspired you to write this musical monument to Liberace?
Well, you know, it was one of those things where I guess at one point in the 60s, when there was, you know, in avant-garde music, composers would, you know, write pieces where they would have a cello in a car and push it off a cliff, or set a cello on fire or something like that. Whatever, you know, sort of a renegade avant-garde music. And so I thought, well, I knew I was writing for a pianist who normally played, you know, very avant-garde music like Pierre Boulez and Stockhausen.
Right.
And the London Sinfonietta was known for playing, you know, very complex British music like Elliot Carter and that sort of thing. So I thought, okay, I'm going to do something. I mean, I always wanted to write a homage to Liberace. And so I knew that this would be controversial. It turned out to be, whoa, did this piece get me in a lot of trouble?
Really?
Yeah, but actually the pianist loved it. British critics had a bit of a time with it. But it's always been a favorite of mine, and it takes together things that I can play piano okay, and I used to play boogie-woogie, so the movement we're going to hear it takes the boogie-woogie stuff I used to play as a kid. But Liberace was an interesting character because he played classical music, sort of Reader's Digest,
yeah,
or watered-down,
yeah,
versions of,
sure,
classical music. And it's kind of American in that, you know, that, I mean, you wouldn't dream of that anywhere else in the Western world with classical music. But in America at a particular time period, we did have this kind of watering down of the classics. And,
well,
and
he had a niche all his own in the visuals,
yeah,
for Liberace.
Yeah, the visuals. And, you know, it's over the top. And to me, it was very eccentric. And also the fact that he was just like Clark Kent and Superman. He was, you know, had this dual thing where, you know, he was gay, but, you know, he couldn't admit it during his time period. And he had to pretend that, you know, he would, like, you'd see in Hollywood magazines, you know, Liberace out with Ava Gardner or something on a date, you know. So it was interesting that he had this side he had to hide. And I've always been interested in that because many composers, when I was growing up, they would say, oh, I love rock, I love Frank Sinatra, I love jazz. And then they would write these 12-tone pieces where you would never know that they even liked that kind of music. So they would hide their true passions. And that was sort of a metaphor for me for this piece that, you know, I wanted to, but this case I didn't hide it. So I wanted to show, I guess the thing that's hidden is my passion for avant-garde music, you know, which is there in a sort of subverted way. So there you go.
So here's the first movement from the Tombo de Liberace. You know, Liberace also had one of the great showbiz lines. He was known for wearing furs and jeweled rings and that kind of thing. He had a very large feminine following, too.
Yeah, yeah.
And And he is known for having held his fingers out before the audience and said, "Do you like my rings? I hope so, because you paid for them."
Yeah. Why did people like that? I mean, it's interesting. It's true. It's like everybody loved that line, Liberace. It's like, you pay. And my grandmother was a huge fan of him. So
why did you get in trouble for writing this piece?
Well, because I would say that the music that is normally played in London, you know, contemporary music, tends to be music without grooves, without melodies, without references to anything in pop culture. And that's partly because I think in America, our popular culture, frankly, I like British rock music, but by and large, British humor you see on television or whatever is kind of crass, actually, I find it. There's a sophisticated...
Potent, uh-huh.
Yeah. I mean, America has a sophisticated history of popular entertainment, you know, going, you know, Sinatra and, those incredible recordings, Capitol Records and Broadway musicals, you know, Rodgers and Hammerstein. We have a very sophisticated history of popular music, which I don't think they really have in Europe. I mean, the popular music, popular stuff tends to be nothing worse than hearing a Dutch rock band. You know what I'm saying? It tends to be kind of like the pop music's kind of, pop stuff's kind of crass, and then you have classical music or high art. I think here we have something in between that, and I think we have a very strong, like I said, history of popular culture, so which is interesting and sophisticated.
Well, it certainly provides for some razzle-dazzle music from some of the American composers, too. It's almost anything goes, and it makes me wonder just a little bit if classical music hasn't really become much more popular in the last 20 years or so. I hate to use that word accessible, but I mean, there's so much that the first hearer can get out of it that I don't think was true if you go back.
You mean with the composers today?
Yeah.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. Sure. Yeah. Yeah. And I think, generally accessible, that's kind of a weird word. I mean,
it's another, popular word, a little too popular.
Another way to think about it is that, you know, that you, when you write music, you think outside of, okay, you think about yourself and what your needs are, but then you think about other people too. You think about the musicians, think about the conductor, you think about the audience members. I mean, you take them into account. So I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I think that probably most of the great art of the past did do that, frankly.
Well, we're going to have this quiz question here, and then I'm going to ask you about this next piece that won, was it a Grammy?
It won three Grammy Awards in 2010.
It won three Grammy Awards.
Yeah, Deus Ex Machina was a piano concerto I wrote.
Good year.
Did a very good year.
This is part of a wonderful musical tradition, the tradition of music about trains. Mm. And you have boarded the procession exactly. With a wonderful piece called Night Steam. And are you a train aficionado, or what exactly inspired you to write Night Steam?
Well, the Night Steam is the third movement of a piano concerto, Deus Ex Machina. I've always been a huge fan of trains. When I lived in Europe, you know, when I was a student, I got those train passes and would go all over
passes,
the trains,
sure,
you know.
Yeah.
I once had a composition lesson with Giorgio Ligeti on a train.
Oh, really?
And because, you know, he was so busy, so sometimes when I was studying with him in Europe, I would follow him around but my train pass was only good for Germany, so it was a train from Hamburg, and once they hit the French border, I had to get out of the train and go back to Hamburg because I didn't have a... But I've always loved trains, and I think being in motion in the States, I love to do road trips. I love to get in my car and drive around, and that's how I get ideas for my pieces, frankly. If I'm stuck, I just get in my car. I'll go for a drive somewhere. You know, I drive out in the country, drive along the river or whatever, you know, or go for a bike ride. Being in motion, in other words, is great. So, and this, the last movement is inspired by the photography of O. Winston Link, Link, who did these amazing black and white photographs in the late 50s, early 60s, of the final steam trains. And you can go online, O. Winston Link, Link. And you'll see these incredible photographs, these gigantic steam engines roaring down at night.
Yeah,
time.
There's something kind of haunting about them, isn't it?
Yeah, so...
So here it is, Night Steam, and this features, pianist is Terrence Wilson here with the Nashville Symphony. Giancarlo Guerrero is the conductor, the composer. Michael Daugherty has been my guest today. Thanks for stopping by.
It's been great. We'll hopefully see you at the concert Friday night at the University of Wisconsin School of Music.
Tomorrow night, 8 o'clock.
7:30.
Nope. 8 o'clock.
Was 8 o'clock?
7:15 is the pre-concert.
Oh, I'm sorry. So 8 o'clock. Great. We'll see you there.
Be there.
Thank
All right.
you.
Here it is, Night
All
Train.
Right. Bye for now.
And the crowd loved it. That was the last of the three movements of Deus Ex Machina, 2007 piano concerto by Michael Daugherty, who was my guest today for the midday. And that particular movement is called Night Steam. We heard also the Nashville Symphony, Giancarlo Guerrero conducting.